Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today, we're talking about Beowulf. Beowulf is the brand new Image Comics publication written by Santiago Garcia and drawn by David Rubin. It was published here in the States in January of 2017. It is a straight-up, down-and-dirty graphic novel retelling of the classic epic poem of the same name, Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned before, it's an Image Comics publication. So Claire is going to tell us more about Beowulf and kind of the, I guess, cultural history and what it's done for Western culture. And I'm going to go in depth into the founding of Image Comics, because we've talked a lot about Marvel and we've talked a lot about DC, but we haven't really talked about Image Comics and where they came from and what they do. So I really wanted
I'm
to make
so
sure
excited.
That that's
and
what I focused
slightly
on.
Jealous that you get to do this.
Yeah. Well, we'll do more Image Comics in the future, Claire. And let me tell you, there's a wealth of information out there. You will be able to find so much more stuff on it. And my segment's already going to be too long as it is anyway. So Claire, why don't you take it away and tell us about Beowulf?
Well, when we started talking about this topic a month or two ago, I was really excited. I think we both were.
Yeah.
Because Beowulf is considered by many to be the first great work of literature in English. It is definitely one of the oldest surviving poems in English. And I was so excited because I thought, okay, I'm going to get to research not only the history of the characters in the poem, the Geats and the Danes, who are basically old school Vikings, but also how this poem has affected all the works that we read today. Now, I'm going to get to that in a second, but you'll see, like, it's a bit of a story. Or not a story. You'll see.
Goody, goody, goody. Had you read the original poem before?
Read the original poem. I had to read it in my English class senior year.
Nice.
Yeah, did you read it before?
I did. I had to read it in high school as well. I forget what year.
Yeah, I remember it being worse, not worse, harder than I thought.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, a lot of, you know, this is an, I guess, kind of an ancient-ish poem.
Ancient-ish, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
It's like 700s or something like
well,
that?
Well, yeah, it's between the 6th and 11th century is when
roughly.
People generally agree that's when it was written. But unlike other, say, ancient Latin or ancient Greek poems, the author is completely unknown. The date's not known. And it's also, you know, assumed that the material had been in circulation in oral narrative for many years before it was actually written down.
Yeah.
It was. We do know that it was composed in England, but we don't know where.
Oh,
now,
I didn't realize it was composed in England.
Old English.
Yeah, I
now
guess that's
here,
true.
The thing is, this for those of you who don't know, Beowulf is the story of a Geat or Swedish hero coming over to Denmark to help the Danish king take care of some monsters he's dealing with, and then there's much. I mean, 1,000-year-old spoiler, and then he goes back to Sweden where he becomes king and then gets killing a dragon.
Yeah.
I think that's the basic bones of the story.
He fights three big monsters. Last one is the dragon.
The last one is the one that takes
them
out.
And they kill each other. Yeah.
Right. So you might ask, why is this poem that is written in English about Danish and Scandinavian kings? Well, the events in this poem date back to before 793 CE, right?
CE, also known as AD.
AD, Common Era.
Common Era,
yes. And this is in 793, the Anglo-Saxons, or what we would know as Vikings, invaded England. So basically, it's these Vikings writing about their, or telling a story, I should say, because most of them weren't writing this, writing about their ancestors. The best way I can think of to describe it is say that a descendant of British parents living in India during the full reign of the British Empire writing a story about people in England.
Yeah, like 100 years ago or something.
100,
like
100 you know, years ago, but yeah. Like his people, his culture.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way
to describe
it. Yeah,
no, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
All right. So another question about Beowulf you might have is that why is it composed in English, not in Danish
or Swedish,
if it was written by Vikings? Well, when the Vikings invaded England, they brought a lot of closely related German languages to England, and those languages eventually evolved into Old English. Now, Old English is what Beowulf is written in, but me and you, we wouldn't be able to read it or recognize it today. It would look totally foreign to us.
So Old English is actually really close to Swedish and Danish and German.
Yeah, closer than English is right now, for sure.
Okay.
And the thing is that Old English was what was spoken in England before the Norman invasion in 1066 when William the Conqueror and the French invaded and conquered England. And they basically made the English language more Latinesque over time into the language that me and you know today.
You know what's funny about that Norman conquest is that the Normans were actually Vikings who had settled in France on the Norman coast. And so then, Vikings reinvaded England.
Vikings who had been influenced by Latin language reinvaded England.
So England was invaded by Vikings twice.
Poor England. I think a lot of countries were invaded by Vikings multiple times. Yeah. So here's the thing about Old English. It isn't studied like Latin or Greek. Scholars didn't really focus on it till the mid-19th century. And by then, even though English is the predominant language spoken throughout the world, I guess it wasn't really in the 19th century as much, but even now...
Well, the sun never set on the British Empire.
Right. You know. But even now, when I feel like English is the dominant world language, by the time... people were studying Old English, it was kind of too late to put it into the college curriculum the way Latin and Greek have put in there.
Yeah, you don't see Old English in any college
or high school curriculum. There isn't a body of literature or work that
you would want to learn
ancient
Old
English
has
in a way that ancient Latin and ancient Greek have.
Definitely.
I think they were more constructed empires. They were bigger empires that spoke these languages that wrote down
a
bunch of literature
and
works. What's the word for works? Literature and...
Culture
and just basically
poems.
Not even poems, just history.
Histories.
Wow. Finding words on a podcast. Always fun. And so, like I was saying, less influence on our literary traditions, and therefore there was less incentive to learn this ancient language.
Yeah, that's true, because you'd want to learn Italian maybe to read Virgil, or not Italian, you want to learn Latin to read Virgil and Latin, or Greek to read.
And also, I mean, for English speakers, Latin is a foundation of our language in the same way Old English is, but because it's the more, culturally dominant language.
That is interesting. I'd never thought of that as like there's not a lot to read in the original Old English.
Yeah.
The most famous
piece of work is Beowulf. So this is another question you might derive from Beowulf. Why are these characters Christians? Because Vikings and Danes are very famously pagan.
Yeah.
Well, there was a large-scale conversion of the Scandinavians at the end of the 6th century. So it is often assumed that Beowulf was written by a Christian monk, mostly because monks were the only members of Anglo-Saxon society that had access to writing materials.
And maybe who even knew how to write well.
Exactly. But it's a pagan story. Obviously, it had been told throughout the years coming from a pagan tradition.
Yeah.
But it's told by a Christian poet. So the narrator, when you're reading the poem, and when I was rereading it with this in mind, the narrator is different from the characters. He's kind of viewing from the outside.
Yeah.
And maybe the characters don't believe what he believes. So the characters are pagan, but the narrator places the poem in a biblical context. For example, Grendel, who is one of the monsters.
The first monster.
And Grendel's mother, which, surprise, is another monster.
Second monster.
Are called the kin of Cain.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? I never picked up on that.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the first things I feel like I notice. I'm like, kin of Cain? These are Vikings.
Why would they care about Cain and Abel? Yeah, they wouldn't know.
Because these are odd. Like, there's no crosses.
Yeah,
there's no, like, Sunday mass.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
So one of the reasons this poem is so, important, it is one of the earliest surviving documents of any language written in the vernacular, or basically the language used by the people. And it has allowed historians and sociologists to glimpse into a culture and history of the Anglo-Saxons in the early Middle Ages. Which, you know, I didn't think about it. Reading this in high school, I didn't think about it this way. I think maybe my teacher brought it up and I just didn't pay attention. But it's a primary source view of medieval society, culture, and literature. And here are some of the things we learn over the course of the poem. This society is very concerned with honor, vassalage, and lineage. And any threat to any of these things will probably lead to violence. We also learn that these people consisted of tiny tribes that would rally around strong kings who would protect them from danger, be that other tribes or monsters or dragons. And this created a warrior culture. The king demanded bravery and loyalty from their warriors and paid them in treasure won from the conquests. Mead halls like Heorot, which is the main mead hall in Beowulf where Grendel first starts attacking, were places where warriors would gather.
The real lesson that I learned from Beowulf as a high schooler reading it was that true men wrestle monsters naked in the dark.
Yeah, that is really something to take from Beowulf.
That is exactly what I took from Beowulf.
Yeah.
So I practice that to this day.
Really? And you're alive, so I just assume you're a true man, Kyle. Depends what the monster is, though.
Does,
a monster can
does.
Be so many.
But the monster is my inner self-doubt that I wrestle with naked in the dark.
I'm happy.
Every day.
Every morning. So this is kind of where the wrench gets thrown into my excitement. Only one manuscript of Beowulf survived the Anglo-Saxon era, and it was mostly forgotten about until the 19th century. And in fact, until the Icelandic scholar Grímur Jónsson Þorkelin made the first transcription of the manuscript in 1786 and published it in 1815, before that, it was in Old English. No one had transcribed it before.
And there's only one copy of it. The funny thing to think about is that if there were other copies in England, in monasteries at that time, there's a good chance they were burned in those monasteries by other pillaging Vikings pillaging England.
Well, this almost got burned, not by Vikings, but I think in like the 1600s or something.
Just
it narrowly escaped a fire. So we almost didn't have Beowulf. And once it was published, it was actually used primarily as historical text for source info about the Anglo-Saxon era. Only history and sociological professors were using it.
Really?
Do you know what the turning point for the poem was?
I know that J.R.R. Tolkien, our favorite, was the one who kind of got it to the forefront of our Western culture.
Yes,
he wrote that for a long time. Yeah, he used to perform it at Oxford. He'd like do these live readings of it, dressed in like a fur and
as
stuff.
Grendel,
as like an old Carl, like like a Huscarl.
Yeah, J.R.R. Tolkien, our man, wrote the essay Beowulf, the Monsters, and the Critics, and it was the first time the poem was examined for its literary merits, not just an example of early English language. And this essay brought Beowulf out of obscurity and into prominence and made it what it is today, which is recognized as one of the finest pieces of English literature.
Just another reason to love J.R.R. Tolkien, or to not like him if you really hated reading Beowulf
right.
in school.
And I will link, I will put a link to this essay. I got about halfway through, and unfortunately, like, just time-wise, I didn't have time to finish it.
Yeah.
But it is really interesting in how he talks about other English literature critics critique Beowulf. It's actually, it's a little scathing. It's good.
He's very defensive of it. He's like, don't you talk smack about Beowulf. You don't
Or
even
like,
know.
You're just not looking at it right.
Yeah.
But anyway, this debunked all the things I was excited about for researching for this podcast. Because Beowulf wasn't taken seriously as a piece of literature until the 20th century, it didn't really impact English literature at all before then.
Yeah.
So like Mary Shelley, you know, Jules Verne, any of the great English science fiction writers were certainly not influenced by Beowulf. Yeah.
No. Most likely not.
And I mean, obviously you can argue after, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien published his essay that, you know, more contemporary writers were, of course, influenced by Beowulf, but not before then. However, this is the kind of silver lining that I've drawn. J.R.R. Tolkien was deeply influenced by Beowulf. I mean, you can see it in so many parts of his Middle-earth world.
Yeah,
for example, like someone stealing a cup and waking up a sleeping dragon is very plainly influenced by Beowulf.
Yeah.
Also, just the overall, the values, the men, you know, and their vassals and loyalty and honor are all very highly placed in J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth. And you can argue that that is derived from Beowulf. And because we can't seem to get away from high fantasy, which is wonderful. I'm not complaining.
We have been a lot of it recently.
It's been great. We've talked about J.R.R. Tolkien for our last two episodes. So what we've come to is that J.R.R. Tolkien is the father of high fantasy.
Yeah.
Like any modern high fantasy, even if it's not directly influenced by J.R.R. Tolkien, you look by the other sources they're influenced by and guarantee you're going to come right back to Tolkien.
Yeah.
So because Beowulf was so influential for Tolkien and high fantasy is my favorite genre, I can argue that my favorite part of literature was very influenced by Beowulf.
Yeah, that high fantasy might not be here today if not for Beowulf.
Or high fantasy would look very different.
Or it would look very different. Yeah, that's true. If J.R.R. Tolkien is the father of high fantasy, partially because we don't know who actually wrote Beowulf, because maybe that person would actually be the father.
Some Viking.
No, yeah, some monk, it seems like.
Well, but the monk wrote it.
He's not like Homer
who was telling
the story. That's very true.
Well, that's my segment.
That was pretty sweet, Claire. I loved Beowulf when I read it in school. It was one of the few kind of old things that, and I didn't think I would like it when I first read it, but it's just so manly.
We can talk about this in opinions, but I sure didn't connect with it.
Yeah.
I'm like, why are they? His mom is just angry, okay?
You killed her son. Why?
Yeah, I definitely didn't connect with it in that way. But let's hear about Image Comics first.
Yes.
And then we'll get to our opinions.
And then we'll get into Beowulf. Well, my segment is quite different than what your presentation on Beowulf. I'm going to focus on Image Comics as a company. And I'm disclaimer here, I'm sort of forsaking the creators of the Beowulf comic that we focused on a little bit to talk more about Image Comics as a company, because when I started researching it, it became really fascinating, and it's actually really cool and way different than how I thought it started.
Right. Well, almost every comic we've done on this podcast is from Image.
So that's what I was going to bring up. You know, I want to talk today a bit about Image. We have done, including this episode, 5 DSRA podcasts purely about a comic, something that was just a graphic novel or comic, no movie or show. Of these 5 purely comic episodes we've done, 4 of them have been Image Comics. The only one that wasn't was Marvel's Squirrel Girl. It's the only exception for the comic book episodes we've done not being Image.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Image makes cool stuff.
And in all these past episodes, we've never really talked about Image as a company or where they came from. So that's really what I'm going to try to focus on today.
I have researched Image for an episode. I forget what one. I think it was Wicked and Divine.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I just didn't have the time.
Yeah, it's
like,
really
by the time you've
it.
Gone into, you know, all the influences
yeah.
and like where the creators are pulling their influences from.
Was like, I was up at like 1 a.m. a couple nights ago just reading sales percentage figures between DC and Marvel and Image, being like, whoa, what's happening here?
Isn't it amazing how interesting that gets?
Yeah, you really fall down a rabbit hole with this research sometimes. At least I do.
I do too.
So Image for me has always been kind of the other one. If DC and Marvel are mom and dad, then Image is that kind of weird uncle you can't quite get a read on. But as you get older, you start to realize he's actually pretty cool. Like maybe, you know, you'll grab a beer with him, or you find out he smoked weed all the time when you were a kid or something.
I was gonna say, not a beer. He like introduces you to like mezcal.
Yeah, it's something, yeah, something cool. Coca liquor, something like that. But at the same time, for me, Image has also seemed like this kind of creative utopia where artists and writers get together and just create without the man, quote unquote, to hold him down, you know?
I hate the man.
I hate the man too. And what I learned is Image also hates the man, but also sort of became the man, but then went back to hating the man. So let's get into that. Because the whole idea of like Image as this utopian communist writer society is really, really far from the truth.
As are all communist governments.
They certainly are. Because when Image started, it was described by one of its founders as a frat house.
Ooh. Oh, I have no good associations with frat houses.
Me too. And I watched a documentary on it, which we can link to on the Facebook page. If you have Amazon Prime, it's free. It's all about the founding of Image. It was very, very interesting. Now, I want to pull back a little to establish somewhat of the dark history of comics and what the comic book publishers and studios like Marvel and DC have done to some of comics' greatest creators. And some of the stuff was the catalyst for Image forming. So all the way back to 1938, a guy named Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel create Superman. Obviously, you know who Superman is. They are paid $130 for Superman by what would become DC Comics. At the time, was National Comics. In the 1940s, their names would be stripped from the Superman credits, so they're not even on the credits anymore. In the 1970s, when the Superman film came out and was making millions of dollars, they sued DC to get some sort of compensation for creating this character.
Did they get it?
They won an annual $20,000 a year, which is actually not a lot.
I know. I mean, I'm thinking of me. I'm like, well, I could use $20,000 a year.
Yeah, but in the grand scheme of things, of Superman, yeah, that these guys are getting $20,000 a year for this thing that they created. So another, and this one's kind of controversial, this next one. Stan Lee, everybody's mm-hmm. favorite comic book creator, took partial and full credit for creating characters that he debatably had very little to do with. And in doing this, he alienated longtime creative partner and legendary artist Jack Kirby, who just had his 100th birthday, was 2 days ago.
It's funny because Stan Lee is so beloved. But I always grew up hearing that, like, he had screwed people out of money.
Yeah.
So I never quite understand how he kind of managed to shed all that and just become like everyone's favorite weird grandpa.
He made a lot of money.
Yeah.
I think that helps. So Jack Kirby, it seems, had a much larger hand in the creation of these characters like the Hulk, Thor, Iron Man, the X-Men, and the Fantastic Four. Those are some checks to be cashed. And was and only recently given co-creator status on a lot of these characters, has still not seen any money on royalties for these characters,
really?
His estate. Nope. And he had to sue Marvel in the 80s just to, and this is the 70s, it was resolved in the 80s, just to get his original artwork back. Because he had done the character designs for all these and helped create these characters. And he knew that if he tried to sue for co-creatorship, he wasn't going to win. But he's like, maybe if I sue just to get my original sketches back, I can auction those off and make some money. And Marvel's like, no. And he had to sue them, and it was taken to court, and he got most of those back. And he did get his name co-creator
Whoa.
Credit on a lot of those characters.
No one can see this. My mouth is hanging open.
Yeah. But he worked.
I didn't realize it was that bad.
Yeah. Apparently, he worked until he died to pay his bills.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Kirby estate is right now, or at least they were, this is an article from 2015, we're in the process of trying to get royalties out of Disney and Marvel.
Oh, my goodness.
And, I mean, when you're going up against a machine like Disney, you got to wonder, are you going to get...
Man, makes Stanley just sound like a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, there is debate on this. Like, people do say that he had he did have a really big hand in creating these characters, and I'm sure he did. But
no matter what, he worked with Jack Kirby to create them.
Exactly.
And he
exactly.
has seen none of it.
Yeah.
I didn't know that he was seeing nothing.
Yeah.
Whoa. Keep going, please.
So it's kind of sad.
I'm sitting here disgusted.
So now I want to fast forward to the late 80s in Marvel. There are a bunch of new, young, talented artists hired on to Marvel to help re-energize the comic mm-hmm. book company and re-energize the brand. And I want to start talking about some of these young artists who were working for Marvel in the late 80s and early 90s and what they were doing. And with that, the previous knowledge of that Marvel and DC also, you know, would screw over creators and kind of take all their money and not give them any compensation for things that they helped create. Now, one of these young talents was Todd McFarlane, who made a name for himself in the early 80s drawing Spider-Man. And apparently he had flooded Marvel with artwork and submissions trying to get hired. And he says he thinks he was hired just because they got tired of getting all his packages, like 300 packages in a month. And they're like, just give this guy a job. But he started writing for Spider-Man and he made a big name for himself. People really liked the way he was drawing Spider-Man. One of the things he pioneered was what they call the spaghetti webbing, which this Spider-Man's webbing, when it was drawn before, was normally just kind of a bunch of X's connected and shooting towards an object. He got really, really detailed with the webbing. So that webbing that you see in Spider-Man comics, which is very detailed with like little bits and stuff kind of hanging off it, that was Todd
McFarlane.
Probably
the bane of every artist since.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I got to draw all this little webbing. Crap on all the webbing. It sucks. Well, in 1991, he was given his own Spider-Man comic run that he would write and draw. And this new McFarlane run on Spider-Man was a massive success. The first issue of the Spider-Man run that was written and drawn by Todd McFarlane sold 2.5 million copies, which is was the world record at that time for the most single issues of a comic sold ever. In these issues, McFarlane co-created the characters of Eddie Brock and Venom.
Oh.
So he made some pretty important characters. And he also clashed with Marvel all the time about the way he was writing and drawing Spider-Man, because they were saying it's too dark. And he was like, well, it's selling really well.
He's like, have you seen Chris Nolan's Batman?
Have you? Exactly.
Darkness sells.
Well, one of the things he mentioned is that they put him on Spider-Man when he was new and Spider-Man was kind of suffering. And they let him have his own run on it, and it did really, really well. And all of a sudden, now that it's doing well, they would jump back and get really hands-on. When it's like, look, you put me on here because it was doing bad, and I got to do whatever I want, and I made it great. And now that it's great, you want to get your hands all over it again. So
Sounds like the man.
McFarlane clashed a lot with the Marvel execs on that. With the man. Another one of these young artists was Rob Liefeld. Liefeld started working on Marvel's New Mutants series starting with issue number 86, and he's generally credited for turning what was Marvel's lowest grossing X-Men series into a financial success. This is in 89. Liefeld was then given...
Did he
given...
bring Wolverine back?
No. Wolverine was being written by another one of these Image guys at the time. So Liefeld was then given full control of a new X-Men series called X-Force, whose debut issue in 1991, same year as McFarlane's Spider-Man number one, sold 4 million copies, breaking the recently broken record by McFarlane. Liefeld is a co-creator of the character Cable. Note, not Nathan Summers, just Cable. Nathan Summers is Scott Summers, Cyclops' younger brother. Cable is kind of his X-Men name, and Liefeld created Cable. But Liefeld also created a little guy named Deadpool.
No one's heard of him.
No one's heard of Deadpool. Not yet. And this is my... There's seven creators who founded Image. I'm only going to focus on these three for now because it'd be too much to focus on all seven. But this third one, another one of these young, talented artists who joined in the late 80s, early 90s, was a guy named Jim Lee, who as artist and co-writer with Chris Claremont did X-Men Volume 2. The first issue of X-Men Volume 2 sold 8.2 million copies
Another
in 1991.
Record broken.
Breaking the record that was just broken by Liefeld, which was just broken by McFarlane.
These kids are killing it.
All in the same year. Jim Lee was also a co-creator of the character Gambit, along with numerous other X-Men characters.
And Channing Tatum will be playing Gambit in a theater one
exactly.
day soon.
And his design and artwork for the X-Men became what the popular 90s cartoon was based off of. All those character designs in the 90s cartoon, he drew those. That was him. 8.2 million copies of a single issue of a comic sold is still the world record for the most amount of one single issue of a comic. Now, these three comic superstars, along with four other heavyweights at Marvel, heavyweight comic artists, Mark Silvestri, who worked on X-Men and Wolverine, Wills Portacio, who worked on X-Men, co-created the character Bishop, Eric Larson, who worked on The Amazing Spider-Man, and Jim Valentino, who worked on Guardians of the Galaxy, all kind of were getting a little frustrated with Marvel. These seven artists consisted of every major X-Men artist from Marvel at the time, both the Spider-Man artists from Marvel at that time, and the artist/writer of the best-selling non-X-Men, non-Spider-Man, non-Hulk comic, which is Valentino doing Guardians of the Galaxy. They represented 11 of the top 12 Marvel comics sold and 44 of the top 50.
Whoa.
So these guys were kind of the workhorses of Marvel. And one of the things they note, and this is something that Todd McFarlane goes on rants about, which I saw in this documentary, that they were breaking all these records. They were receiving very little compensation for that. And they weren't receiving any accolades at work. And the Marvel CEO at that time even was quoted as saying that creators are interchangeable. It's the characters that are important. So you could switch out creators and stuff and it didn't matter.
Yeah, so it doesn't excuse you not paying Jack Kirby.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's very true. So they were all pissed off and were like, look, if we all leave at the same time, we can make a huge statement. And they did, to form their own company. Now, this was a huge blow to Marvel. In fact, when the press got word that all these artists left Marvel at the same time, their stock fell by $3.25. And like I said, these guys got together and founded Image. Now, the rules of Image, the three rules that they started with and have stayed with, Image will never own anything other than the Image logo. Each partner will be autonomous within Image, and creators own what they create 100%. They own everything. Image was actually six separate companies under one banner. Each member of Image, all the seven guys who left, started their own company, and they would put the Image logo on any comics that they released. With Wills Protasio, the seventh, joining with Jim Lee's company. He just stayed on with Jim Lee. Now, the first years of Image Comics were a golden age, with Rob Liefeld's Young Bloods number one, which was Image's first official comic, selling 500,000 copies in its first run. And the success was far greater than anyone, including the Image founders, ever imagined. All of the founders created their own characters and owned 100% of those characters. And Todd McFarlane created the character Spawn and has used Spawn to make himself a millionaire with merchandising.
Oh, that's awesome.
And toys. And that was one thing that McFarlane and these other artists were really pissed about, is they would draw these covers for X-Men comics or Spider-Man comics, and then they'd see their covers printed on all these t-shirts being sold. And they weren't seeing anything from it.
Yeah. Ugh.
So it bothered them a lot. And this is where it gets really, really crazy. In August of 1992, Image displaced DC as the number two seller of comic books, which was crazy.
That's
for the
insane.
Time.
Yeah.
It had always been Marvel number one, DC number two.
It still is now.
Yeah, it still is now. 1 year into Image being around, and they are number two all of a sudden. Mm. The crazy thing about this is they did this only having six titles. There were only six different kinds of characters you could buy at Image, as opposed to like about 60 for DC. I think it was like 54.
Whew. Batman and wasn't good.
I guess not. And this led Rob Liefeld, one of the guy who created Deadpool, one of the founders of Image, saying that we broke Batman's back, we killed Superman. What he's saying is that DC was so frantic about being displaced as number two that they had to pull some drastic stuff in their comics. That all of a sudden, they're like, oh, we gotta do something crazy because we need people to come back. So Batman's getting his back broken by Bane and Superman's dying by Doomsday. And they said it was within weeks of them displacing them. All of a sudden, it came out.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Also, Liefeld's comic, Young Bloods, that he did with Image, the next year, both Marvel and DC had issues and titles that sounded like Young Bloods. They had one called Bloodline and one called like Super Bloods or something, because they saw how successful Image was being. So 1992 was just a huge, huge year for Image, with sales through the roof, with all these brand new characters. And DC eventually did move back to the number two spot, but the damage had been done and Image had earned the respect and hatred of the big two, DC and Marvel. Now, Image did start to have problems, mostly because these were seven artists, not seven businessmen. So after the initial big boom, they were making all this money in the first year, a lot of them got lazy. They became notorious for missing deadlines, for putting the wrong covers on certain comics and stuff. And it got to a point where Todd McFarlane gathered all the Image creators together and started yelling at all of them, be like, you guys need to get your stuff out on time. I'm the only one who ever gets my issues out and on time and organized, and you're damaging our brand. And another big thing that happened.
That's still a thing with Image, though, where the comics come out when the comics come out.
Another big thing that hurt Image, and this hurt all the comic companies, and this also may have been part of why the sales for Image and for the guys from Image when they worked at Marvel being so high, is the comic speculator bubble popping. So in the early 90s, there was this idea that collecting number one issues of comics, if you held them for 30 years, they were going to be worth $1 million.
Right.
So all these people were collecting number one issues, and Marvel was printing multiple number one issues with different collector's covers and stuff. So everyone was buying up all these number one issues. And when it turned out that none of those comics were ever going to be worth anything because they're all, you know, super common because so many of them were printed, the bubble popped, and that actually caused Marvel to enter bankruptcy in 1997.
Which is why we have Marvel movies.
Why
we have superhero movies.
Period. Yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing. The very first big superhero movie that came out, mm-hmm. I mean, other than Superman, obviously, in the 70s, was Todd McFarlane's Spawn in 1997.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it turned into an HBO show that won an Emmy, actually. And it was an animated adult HBO show. So the comics bubble popping really damaged image. and also there started to become some drama between the founders, specifically Rob Liefeld. He was kicked out. I can't go into this now because I'm already taking too long on this, but it's pretty juicy gossip.
It'll be our next Image comic segment. Story. Hopefully I get it.
Yeah.
I did love doing Beowulf.
So Jim Valentino, who was the guy who worked on Guardians of the Galaxy, he was one of the founders of Image. He kind of stopped creating in the late 90s, and what he started doing instead was going out looking for talent in other genres to publish in an attempt to diversify Image's catalog and kind of change its perception. He wanted to start publishing things in comic form that weren't normally in comics. And this is the business practice Valentino started that Image has really taken on today, and that's kind of what it is today, where they go out and try and find other people's work to publish, and they don't take a percentage. They charge a flat rate. And the creator of that comic retains 100% control. And one thing that really helped kick this off and legitimize Image doing this was Robert Kirkman's Walking Dead, which is an Image comic and is one of the major, major success stories of Image right now.
Yeah.
So a few facts and figures about the comics industry right now. Marvel typically hovers a little under 40% of the market of comics. 40% of comics bought are Marvel's. DC is a little over 30%. It's like 31, 32, and these all fluctuate. And Image hovers around, 10 to 12. But the interesting thing about Image is their emphasis is on their trade paperbacks, not on their single issues. They typically sell a lot more trades than Marvel or DC.
Yeah, I buy Image trades.
Yeah, me too. And they also Image is also sold in bookstores and stuff, which you don't really see with Marvel. You see a little bit with DC, but you don't see as much with Marvel. So that's kind of my talk on Image. I have a lot, but we should really move on to opinions.
Well, when we were doing Monstrous, I remember reading interviews with Marjorie Liu, who's the writer for Monstrous, saying that she worked for Marvel. I think it was Marvel. And that how Image was just this haven of you can do whatever you want. And like no notes, no input. And that you kind of work for a DC or Marvel to make a name for yourself.
Exactly.
And then the ultimate goal is to go create your own thing at Image.
An Image, yeah. That can be branded and marketed and might get a movie deal or even just your own thing that no one's going to put input on.
Right, no one's going to say anything about it.
No one's
going to
tell you what you can and can't do, which is really interesting. And I do like their business model of doing that. Because when it first started, it was just the seven guys. It's like whatever those seven guys wanted to put out. Valentino in the late 90s was the one who really started trying to diversify Image and make it.
I think they do have a really diverse, cool portfolio of work.
Me too.
I should say.
They're my favorite comic company right now. When I think about the comics I read, most of them are Image comics because they're just unique and interesting. And they're a little bit different than the superhero, genre that is maybe getting a little tired these days. And I know I feel bad. I didn't really get to talk about Santiago Garcia or David Rubin much or about this Beowulf comic. But Claire, what did you think of this Beowulf graphic novel?
Okay, so I think it's a really beautiful, cool novel, and it's very true to the Beowulf story.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, learning that this is the root of my favorite literature genre, it's not a story that I'm particularly enthralled with. I'm like, okay, great. I mean, when I start reading it and you start seeing like the historical context of it and just like, the Christianity mixed in, that I'm fascinated by. Yeah. But as a story, which is what this, what this graphic novel is, it's not written for me.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
I was a little underwhelmed with it as well. I think the art is really cool, but I think I was expecting a bit more. And what I got was pretty literally just the story of Beowulf with images, with
but
pictures.
When you say you were expecting more, define more.
So I saw, and this movie was panned, like a lot of people didn't like it, and I get made fun of by some friends about it. But I saw the Neil Gaiman Beowulf, Neil Gaiman written Beowulf, Robert Zemeckis directed Beowulf, came out in like, it was 2006 or 2007.
With Angelina Jolie, I remember.
With Angelina Jolie. And that was like a kind of different take on Beowulf. And it, you know, because I knew the story, but it kind of switched up the story a bit. And I really liked it. I thought it was really cool and interesting. And I'm not going to say it's better than the original, but it was a fun take and it enthralled me. And I was thinking, I thought that there would be a bit of a spin
just
on it.
Just more of a unique take on,
yeah,
on what the story was. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I think part of it too is I think I thought it was going to be a different story. I thought it was going to be more about in like a high fantasy vein, when instead the graphic novel was in more of like a really visceral, kind of quiet and violent
right
way.
Yeah, you know? I think they were trying to evoke like that gritty world.
Yeah.
Which they did a good job with. I mean, we should talk a little bit about the art. It is really cool.
Yeah.
Like it's drawn in like reds and grays
and blacks,
black.
Yeah.
Not a lot of color besides red.
Yeah. Blood everywhere.
Right. And you were saying it almost has like a Geiger-esque style with Grendel.
Yeah, I thought Grendel and Grendel's mom
Geiger
and the dragon.
Geiger is the artist that influenced the Alien and Aliens.
Yeah, that created the Alien and Aliens.
And Alien and Aliens, yeah.
Yeah, it did. When I first saw Grendel, I was like, that looks a bit like, you know, the Xenomorph, the Alien.
That looks like my boy.
That looks like my boy. There were really cool parts in this graphic novel where it would kind of superimpose like a kind of x-ray view over top of the humans, and you would kind of see them as just flesh and meat and blood.
Yeah.
And that's what the monster looked like, too.
The theme of mortality was very strong.
Yeah.
Very, very prevalent.
Yeah, mortality. And I mean, I get that more when I'm thinking back about it, but reading it, the thing that really hit me in it is just like, was honor and pride, which is a big part of the
Beowulf and violence yeah. For sure. It's a very it's rated R, definitely.
It's definitely rated R. Part of what made me think that the Grendel monster was reminiscent of H.R. Geiger was because there's like some phallic imagery with that Grendel monster, and that was a big theme on Geiger's work, especially with Alien and Aliens, and it just even kind of reinforced that even more with me.
Yeah, I wasn't that into that.
I'll be honest, I wasn't super into how the dragon was drawn either and looked. It had its eyes on the same side of its head like a flounder. I remember thinking, like, it's kind of a goofy dragon.
It's funny because I did love the overall, like, gritty, violent feel, because I do think that's this world.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and it wasn't glamorized.
No.
At all, which I kind of appreciate. But on the other hand, like you're saying, like the individual drawings, like the dragon, even Grendel, I wasn't super excited about.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, this is a really amazing take on this.
Yeah. And I thought after seeing Grendel, I was like, all right, that's pretty cool. And I was really curious to see what Grendel's mom was going to look like, because I was like, oh, that could be really interesting what they're going to do with Grendel's mom. And you get to Grendel's mom, who's the second monster Beowulf fights. And she kind of just looks like Grendel again.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. So the artwork was cool, and I think the best parts about it were kind of those overlays where you would see the humans as kind of bags of meat. And that's something you see on the very cover of Beowulf. You see Beowulf's face with Grendel, the monster Grendel, kind of superimposed underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of like there's like a mortality or like a monster and man thing. What's the difference?
Definitely.
Idea
these
there.
These very violent men, what are they?
Yeah. But I also wanted more of a story.
Well, I kind of, this is can take us to the actual text. I felt that way a little bit about Beowulf itself when I was reading it. And that's part of the problem that a lot of these early English critics had with Beowulf.
Yeah, not enough of a story.
Yeah. And I think the story, for me, parts of it are cool, like fighting Grendel and fighting a dragon are cool, but I feel like the themes, like we were saying earlier, of like manliness, you know, like honor and valor.
Yeah.
It doesn't
wrestling
appeal.
Monsters naked.
Yeah, it doesn't appeal.
Yeah.
Not my thing.
I get it. I
Which
wonder.
Is funny because I love high fantasy.
Yeah.
I love when there's more like fleshed out, like I guess.
More
plot.
More meat to the plot.
Yeah, definitely. But then this leads me to another point that. What I do think is cool about these adaptations is that they can maybe tell the story in a different way that could appeal to a modern audience, like, say, a teenage boy or any boy or any person, I shouldn't just say boy, who has never read the story of Beowulf or been intimidated by it. They might actually see this really cool art piece, start reading it here, and then have access to the story in a way that they wouldn't have attempted to have access to before.
That's a very good point.
I was listening to this podcast, Stop and Fangirl, about adapting older stories. And they were saying, one of the girls on there was saying that she gets intimidated, or doesn't get intimidated, but doesn't enjoy a lot of, say, Shakespeare or Austen or earlier works. And I think that sometimes modern adaptations can be like the gateway drug. And then once you see it done this way, you can then go back and appreciate what the, say, older author.
What Jane Austen was writing. Like you see Clueless and you're like, wow, that's awesome. Oh, that's a Jane Austen book. Mm-hmm.
Actually, and I was going to ask, do you have an adaptation that you prefer, you know, in the more modern version?
Well, I've never read Emma, which is what Clueless is based off of, but I freaking love Clueless. It's one of my favorite movies ever. Easily top five, right up there with Aliens. So I would
say
that.
They're so similar.
Yeah, and just, I mean, we're talking about Beowulf. Neil Gaiman did that Robert Zemeckis. He wrote that Robert Zemeckis movie, Beowulf, which I enjoyed, but he also did a short story in the American Gods universe. It was like a novella at the end of his Fragile Things short story book about Shadow that was kind of based around Beowulf. And I thought that was also another really interesting, really cool take on an old story, on this old story of Beowulf. So those right there are a couple. There's plenty too, especially if you're talking about Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are some for you?
I was going to say Clueless as well, because Clueless is just
the best.
Great.
It's
and Emma best. Is not Austen's best book.
Yeah.
What else? I guess I'm thinking of like these late 90s, early 2000s movies, but I love 10 Things I Hate About You. I wouldn't say that it's better. And another Shakespeare that might not be better, but is excellent in its own right, is West Side Story.
Very true, yeah. And you're totally right about adaptations. And I had never thought, I didn't really think about this, how they can open the doors to older works and help you kind of appreciate them more. Because I'll probably never read Emma.
See, I remember being excited to read Emma after I had discovered Pride and Prejudice, because I loved that so much and was like, oh, but this is what Clueless is based on.
Yeah.
And actually, I didn't enjoy it as much as Clueless. But I think, I mean, Clueless is great.
Yeah, yeah, that is a great movie. Beowulf by Santiago Garcia and David Rubin is really cool in its own right. I don't think it was for me necessarily, but for people who are like really into Vikings, you know, that show, or into that violent medievalism and are curious about a comic to check out, I would say definitely give it a look. Yeah. It's very well packaged and it's very well put together.
And it's not a long read.
Definitely not. And thank you to Image for getting it out in the U.S. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr., that's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about Beowulf and Image Comics on our Facebook page, where we'll be posting some of our show notes. I actually watched an hour and a half long documentary that's free if you have Amazon Prime to watch on the founding of Image Comics. So definitely, you know, check that out if you're curious. Our producer is James Fowey. Our logo is done by Patty Hyland and our theme was composed by Pete Rowan. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening and we will see you in 2 weeks.